Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson and I'm delighted to be hosting this series of Emerge Australia podcasts in preparation for Severe ME Week. In this series, I'll be interviewing those with severe ME and others with lived experience and their carers, as well as eminent clinicians working in the challenging yet exciting field of infection-associated chronic illnesses like ME, long COVID, and associated overlapping conditions. This series is particularly important to Emerge Australia as we launch our Count ME campaign. Designed to ensure the ME community is counted in data across the health system and in decisions that affect our community's lives at a time when ongoing funding for Emerge Australia's patient services is not guaranteed. To commence today, I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. As we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, never has there been a greater need in my lifetime for the world to celebrate the brotherhood of man globally than now. A world without stigma, a world without discrimination on any grounds, a world where people have equity of access to treatments and medical care, a world where we have biomarkers and diagnostic tests for those with ME and associated conditions, and, dare I dream, a world where we have a cure for these diseases. So today I'm delighted to introduce to you Dr. Jason Lamb, and I'm delighted, Jason, that you can be here on this podcast series today. So thanks so much for your time.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. I'm not quite sure I fit into eminent, but I'll try my best.
Dr. Jason Lamb is a dynamic and multifaceted medical profession with a unique journey from professional dancer to physician. His interest in medicine was sparked during a lung collapse, inspired by a marathon of scrubs. After earning his medical degree at Flinders University in South Australia, Dr. Lamb honed his skills in plastic surgery and dermatology across various tertiary hospitals in the Northern Territory in New South Wales. As a neurodivergent philomath, and I've just learnt what that means, Dr. Lamb embraces a holistic and collaborative approach to patient care, prioritising connection and understanding. His diverse interests range from surgery and dermatology to sports medicine and pain management, but it's his personal experience with chronic complex conditions, including ME/CFS, that drives his commitment to patient advocacy. Having navigated the challenges of hypermobility, orthostatic hypertension, POTS, and ME/CFS following septic shock, he understands firsthand the struggles faced by those living with chronic illnesses. Dr. Lamb is proud to be part of the Australian EDS and HSD network and actively engages in medical education, research, and public speaking on topics such as hypermobility, neurodivergence, and chronic illness. with a touch of whimsy and a penchant for the unconventional, he brings a refreshing perspective to the conversation around ME/CFS. So welcome today, Jason, and it's such a pleasure to be talking with you.
Thanks so much. That's always, it's cringier when you hear it.
Yeah, I do understand that. But, you know, you deserve every bit of the accolades that are in that introduction because you truly are someone who is quite unique. So to kick off today, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your personal journey. I'm really interested to hear about the dance doctor and how that came about, and having you share how your experiences personally have shaped your clinical approach to patient care and advocacy for those with ME/CFS.
Yes, I guess I started off as a professional dancer. So danced with Sydney Dance Company and Opera Australia, a lot of really pretentious kind of contemporary dance, which involves a lot of rolling around on the floor, just a lot of fun. Danced with Taz Dance as well and worked with Graham Murphy. Actually, I had a chance to work with Paul Mercurio, though I don't think he remembers me, back in Sydney Dance days with his standout role, Some Rooms. Yeah, and then that was all kind of kicking along nicely. I was actually over in France at a film festival for us in the finals of a very small, very pretentious film festival. So I thought I'd go over and strut the red carpet a bit. And then, yeah, collapsed a lung, ended up in the ICU, stepped down for a week. No one spoke any English, watched a lot of Scrubs. And yeah, didn't really know how that was going to affect my dancing. And so I reached out to Ken Crichton, who is the doctor for the Australian Ballet at the time. And he didn't really have any much experience with spontaneous pneumothoraces and professional dance, but he was very kind. And yeah, and then I kind of had to move out of dance into something else, and medicine seemed like a good idea. And yeah, I kind of stayed in touch with Ken. I did end up actually bringing back the med review for Flinders University, so I did get my Scrubs musical in the end. And yeah, and then kind of all through med school and early training, I was kind of in touch with Ken. I did, yeah, I was pursuing surgery for a while, but I had other things I wanted to do in surgeries. Very all-consuming and demanding, and I've got a lot of hobbies, and I kind of wanted to do that. So I kind of changed tact and thought I'd go back. And he had actually planted this idea of dance medicine, and so I thought, oh, I'll go back and maybe do that. So I ended up joining the GP training program, and I'm also in the sports med training program, and moved down to Melbourne, and I was the inaugural dance medicine fellow at the Australian Ballet, which was fantastic. Learned a lot from Dr. Sue Mays and Dr. Andrew Garnham and all the physios and all the dancers. Yeah, and then kind of throughout my training in GP, I guess, yeah, because I was known for dancers, I started getting more of that hypermobile population and started seeing some of the, and then particularly when COVID came around, seeing kind of what happens when hypermobile people get something like COVID. Yeah, and so I started seeing more of kind of these overlapping conditions, the trifecta, pentad, septad, nonad, whatever odd number you want to give it. And yeah, and then I guess just by nature, I like working out what's going on. And so I was kind of getting, you know, patients which were having trouble finding answers, and, you know, I'd have quite a bit of fun working out, and evidently managed to work it out for a few people, and then, you know, how it goes, and then people talk, and yeah, it's all kind of gone from there. And yeah, done some talking, and then I guess after, when was it, 2023, yeah, I had a very nice meal but ended up getting sepsis from it, ended up in ICU. My partner kind of jokes that I got the female experience because they basically told me that it's a migraine, just chill out, you're being a bit soft. I thought my raging fever, my CRP of 200 and something and 28 white cells probably argued against a plain migraine. I had to diagnose my own sepsis. When they were doing the lumbar puncture, they caused a quarter equina, which was very embarrassing. But they kept going, just to jiggle it a bit more. And then, yeah, ended up on inotropes in ICU with an art line. And then had the consultant come by the next day and said that I shouldn't have been in there, that it was a soft admit and I should have just slept it off. So that was nice. Yeah. And then got, yeah, discharged out. So, and then kind of after that, I was quite surprised by how fatigued I was. And yeah, had these kind of, was passing out several times, kind of ended up being like an orthostatic hypertension, POTSy sort of thing. It was interesting. I did pass out in the post office, and very interesting to see what people's responses were. The shop owner slapped me in the face a few times and told me that I had to get out of his shop and I couldn't lie there. There was someone else who was announcing that she knew first aid, but wouldn't do any of it, would just loudly proclaim that she, in fact, knew first aid. And then I eventually crawled out of the shop and sorted myself out because no one would actually do anything useful. So yeah, that was fun.
Bystander syndrome to me.
Yeah, it was, yeah, I really liked the slap in the face and to tell me to get out of his shop and that I can't, like, not having a fucking nap here, buddy, you know.
So shocking.
So yeah, so anyway, and then, yeah, they just continued working and then I did a couple of presentations and yeah, just kind of started building more and more. And then, yeah, got involved with the, I've always been seeing hypermobility and then kind of joined one of the core networks. And, you know, you kind of get roped into different stuff. I have zero filter. And so I get trotted out every so often and cause a bit of a fuss in the media. So, yeah.
Not many people have that many things that happen to them that absolutely will shape, you know, their experiences to patient care. How have those experiences shaped you as a doctor? I mean, you know, I just looked up the word philomath before, and it's a lover of learning and studying. And I mean, you are just absolutely that, you know. You didn't just decide to go from the arts and dancing at a high standard to deciding to become a doctor and thinking of surgery and thinking of all the other paths and that you've taken. And now you're in the area of ME/CFS and associated overlapping conditions. I mean, you are a lover of learning and studying. And
or just have a very short attention span.
I'm not going to ask you what the next area you might go on to and going to be. We'll just leave it at that because I know that you're doing some amazing work with people with ME/CFS and overlapping conditions. And so I'm interested in talking a little bit about what you do. But I would like to go back onto script. So many people with ME experience this wide range of symptoms, but those with severe ME face additional challenges. What do you see as some of the specific needs and barriers faced by individuals with severe ME? And what should the medical profession be doing about these?
Yeah, it's a huge spectrum. At the very severe end, like, you know, I've got, and yeah, you know, we all have, you know, patients who are essentially bedbound where even the very basics of living is extending their energy envelope, you know, eating, going to the toilet is a toll. Yep. So that's obviously immensely challenging. And often we find that they are wildly sensitive to anything, you know, light, sound, let alone medications. So that leaves the therapeutics difficult, you know, and then there's the obvious challenges of, well, how do we assess? How do we treat them? Because they can't leave their house to come to an appointment. They can't testing. You know, there's some degree of testing you can do with home visits. So, but, you know, you can't really wheel an MRI around to their house. So, you know, there's a lot of challenges with that. Yeah, just the service provision is the first barrier. And then I guess the second one is just like, well, it's really challenging to treat, you know? So, yeah, it's really tough for them.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's all these Yeah, and with all of this stuff, we know MBCFS is wildly expensive for the patient, for their family. So yeah, there's a massive financial and time cost and emotional cost, you know, for the individual. You know, I certainly went through a bit of that, like grieving what you had, you know, and for the family, you know, and these are typically young people. So, you know, in kind of the prime of their adult life, and then they're not, they're in bed with the curtains drawn. So yeah, I'm lucky. I'm certainly nowhere near that end, but yeah, it's absolutely devastating and challenges on all fronts. As to what to do about it, oh my God. You know, I think funding is always an issue. You know, the Medicare rebate doesn't reflect the amount of work and time. You know, the, you know, home visits are very poorly remunerated. And then there's also, you know, other issues with home visits in terms of safety and how much time it takes you out from your clinic. So, you know, it will take half a day or a day. And so you can't do anything else. I don't know what the solution to that is. And then, you know, we still need to know so much more about the condition. You know, there are clearly different phenotypes. So how do we help these people at the very severe end who react to everything?
Yeah.
You know, that's my toolbox, is some sort of intervention. We need more research and more understanding of how we best do it. You know, I've got my kind of tricks, and, you know, we all have our ways to try and work it out. But yeah, it's super challenging.
Yeah. So I've got to ask this. Can you tell us about some of your bag of tricks?
Yeah. So like really varies. So I've got some people who do really well. There's that study which was the hyperbaric oxygen for long COVID, which was obviously wildly impractical because you have to go to hyperbaric for an hour once a week. I think I costed it out in Melbourne at about $40,000, plus the, you know, having to get to one. But
kind of problem, yeah.
Yeah, but we actually, some colleagues found a bit of a MacGyver way of kind of approaching that, where you can hire an oxygen concentrator for like $130 a month, and you can just stick that on, and it'll give you 90% pure oxygen.
Oxygen, yeah.
And, you know, we get people to do that, you know, several times a day. You know, one of the challenging things was they're not the quietest devices, but, you know, we again MacGyvered a thing where we put it in the other room with a very long tube, and then we hooked it up to one of those Bluetooth power plugs. And then so you can turn it on and off with an app. That has helped some people. There was a small study on sodium chromoglycate in like quite high doses in water and sipped throughout the day. You know, we used to do it with tablets, or, you know, do it several times a day, which is just a lot of work. It's a little, either a lot of work for the patient or a lot of work for the carer. So kind of by doing it, front loading it, you can do it once and then you've got it for the whole day. Just made it a bit easier. And I've had some people do really well with that. Some people have responded really well to the nebulized sodium chromoglycate. Yeah, and then for some others, actually some judicious use of something like a benzodiazepine to try and just calm the system down to allow some other intervention to happen. So sometimes that's been helpful, you know.
Of course, there's been a lot about low-dose naltrexone, but that, again, helps some people and not others.
That's the trick with, that's the problem with all of this. I mean, low-dose naltrexone would be one of the first things that, you know, we try. I have got some people on very low dose naltrexone, because again, some people are so reactive. So that can, you know, these are some of the strategies where I've seen have probably been the most tolerable, or can help people overcome that if that's a challenge for them, you know.
I wonder, just hearing you speak, I wonder whether, you know, we think of MECFS and we think of treatment of MECFS, but I wonder whether by treating one aspect of the MECFS, it makes it more bearable for others. For example, you know, evabradine, or one of the drugs for POTS, in a person who's got MECFS and orthostatic intolerance. Does it make a difference if you just try to focus on that?
Yeah. Yeah, when I'm teaching or like talking about it, absolutely. You know, you want to take the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
ME/CFS is something we don't really know how to treat. We do know how to treat POTS reasonably well. So absolutely you want to take the low-hanging fruit where you can. You know, the kind of the game is lots of different analogies, like a bicycle tire with lots of holes. The game is to plug as many holes as you can. And, you know, what I'm bad with sayings, but, you know, perfect is the enemy of done or something. But you're better off plugging a few holes and being slightly inflated than just staring at it going, bugger it, we don't know what to do. Because then it's definitely deflated, you know. So, you know, and then if you follow the allostatic load sort of model, you know, it's just this overall overwhelmed system. So anything you can do to reduce the demands on the system will give us more capacity for something else. And that's true at any level of ME/CFS. I do get frustrated with, you know, some commentary is like, oh, you're just treating the symptoms, or, you know, you're not getting to the root cause. It's like, well, we don't freaking know the root cause. I mean, kindly, if you do, please tell us all and we'll solve this problem. But in the absence of that, like, and I also don't think it's wrong to treat the symptoms. Like, we have, if your child has a fever, we still treat the fever. Like, you know, if they're uncomfortable, I know there's some new work that, you know, if they're not too uncomfortable, you let them kind of ride it out. But if they're very uncomfortable, you don't say, oh, well, I don't have a treatment for influenza A, so as I can't treat the root cause, you're going to have to suck it up.
Yeah.
Like, treating the symptoms helps, you know, because then they can rest, they can sleep, their immune system can do their thing. Like, you know, so I find that a really odd dichotomy, or like this very rigid view is like, because you don't know the root cause, treating the symptoms is worthless.
Which leads me to the very important area for Emerge Australia of clinical education. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the hopes and aspirations of the new RACGP special interest group on ME/CFS, long COVID and overlapping conditions, which of course you're one of the co-leaders with Associate Professor Bernard Shue and others, because, and that's one question. The reason I'm asking that question is that Emerge Australia does a lot of, as you know, because you're going to be one of our speakers soon, clinical education. And we go to various meetings where we also have a booth and we have someone like yourself speaking. And it is common for doctors to say to us when we say, well, have you got any ME/CFS patients or long COVID patients? It's common for us to hear, no, we don't want to see those patients. We don't know what to do with them. We can't diagnose them. There's nothing we can do. And they're making it up anyway. That's what we hear. We've got a lot of anecdotal evidence that's quite concerning. Can you tell us what your special interest group hopes to achieve and how we can start shifting the needle a little bit to at least say, well, if you've got orthostatic intolerance, maybe we could use evabradine, or if you've got something else, maybe we could use some other off-label drug that might help you with that symptom. Won't cure you, but there's something that might be able to be done. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Not my special interest group. It's Professor Bernard Shue's the lead. I've got David Feinberg, Jenny Huang, myself, and then a whole bunch of other people. Yeah. And so I think it was born out of, this exact frustration. You know, we see it a lot and we hear the stories from patients as well. And so, it's the hope that we can help educate people. And, you know, it's actually really encouraging. There's more and more interest. I was just up at a CPD getaway, medical learning journeys. And lots of people were really interested and recognizing that they're seeing these patients. And I think part of the problem has been that we don't get trained for this. Yeah. And the structure of Medicare and of GP consults is inherently against us. You know, the structure of it is, you know, single issue medicine. So yeah, I think we don't have a framework. So I think that's a real challenge. And then I think as doctors, you know, we like to fix people. That's we want to be able to do it. And so I think, you know, you meet a condition, it's like, oh man, that's really complicated. I don't know what to do about it. I don't think I can do anything about it. So patient feels bad, I feel bad. Maybe we could just skip the whole thing. I don't know, but I think that's, you know, part of it. You know, yeah, we don't have a framework. We don't have a approach for, and we don't have a really good approach for, you know, well, actually, no, it's not true. It's always this kind of argument. It's like, oh, but there's no biomarker. It's like, well, there's no biomarker for IBS. There's no biomarker for concussion. Like, we believe that they're things, but we don't have, you know, and that's going to be a limitation of technology and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
So, yeah, there's this bit of this weird double standard where it's like, oh, I'll believe it when I see a biomarker. It's like, well, you believe a lot of stuff without a biomarker. I mean, let's face it, psychiatry is an entire specialty is without a biomarker, you know? True. So we certainly have the capacity to do it. And we have a bit of a spot with ME/CFS.
You've got to have the inclination to want to do something about it. And I think that the thing that concerns me most, because I go to all of the clinical education presentations, is hearing the response from some clinicians where they just don't really want to know. You know, even if something was there, they don't have the inclination to do anything. And then there's the issue, all the issues you've highlighted of, you know, MBS items, not enough time. The whole system isn't designed to have the necessary time to spend with patients to be able to get a full history and properly diagnose, etc. It's just like for some clinicians, it's too much. They don't want to know about it.
Yeah. Look, that's probably true, you know, and I don't think we're going to get 100%. But that's kind of like with everything, you know, we don't need everyone. We don't need everyone to be an expert. We need everyone to be kind and curious and compassionate. And, you know, and then gradually there will be more people with interest and expertise and appetite to do it. I mean, you know, kind of when we get into the pointier end, like a concern understandable for many clinicians is, you know, there is no TJ appropriate treatment. Really. And so people are worried about, oh, can I prescribe ivabradine? Can I prescribe all these things? You know, this is a classic, you know, I get pushback. It's like this, you know, I titrate a patient and they're doing fine. So they go back to their GP and the GP is like, why are you on naltrexone? Are you drinking? You know, if you're not drinking, then this is not an appropriate drug for you. It's like, oh, it's like 1/10 the dose. Like, but yeah, I can also understand, like, they're hesitant to do that. I mean, I guess, you know, a little less, that's given that I've taken the risk of starting it and that. I'd be really nice if they would continue it. But I can also see why people don't want to start it because, you know, you're stepping outside your lane, perhaps.
Well, that's got something to do with the regulatory framework for clinicians, hasn't it?
Yeah. It's, so that's part of it, the medico-legal kind of environment.
Is that something the special interest group's going to be looking at?
We're going to be certainly got a stuff planned around education around that, yeah.
Yeah, because I sort of think from a patient advocacy perspective, which is what Emerge Australia is, apart from all the other things that we do, that this is an important issue, that it's easier or it is maybe desirable for patient advocacy to take on because there are less risks if patients take it on than if the clinicians take it on. But if we work together, this might be an area we could impact.
Sure. I guess it would probably depend on what that advocacy looks at. I don't think it'll help just humbugging, just yelling at GPs to prescribe off-label.
No, sorry. It's really important that you understand that I'm not having a go at GPs here. I'm actually having a go at the regulatory framework that means GPs are at risk. So we're on your side, don't get me wrong. But, you know, patients can often say things to government, for example, and to advisory groups that clinicians find it very difficult to say. So this is working together on specific issues that are critical.
Absolutely. I think, you know, there needs to be better understanding of what off-label prescribing kind of means. I think actually most doctors would be, if they actually think about it, a lot of the stuff we do is off-label anyway, because it costs so much money to get things on-label. So there's just a lot of stuff that we do anyway, which is off-label. But because it's in a different field and that sort of thing, like, I get it. So, yeah, so I think, you know, a bit more education around that. I'm not a legal expert, so I don't know what the ins and outs of changing the framework or the legalities of it are, because it's not even legislative, I think. It's just legal. You know, it's the insurers which are like going, we don't have appetite for this.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, I'm not sure. That's well outside my lane.
Our former medical director, Dr. Richard Schleffel, used to talk about this in his presentations he did for us. And it remains a huge issue. It's an issue for clinicians.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'd love to see would be, you know, if we could get a section in the therapeutic guidelines, because I think that's what everyone wants, is something to back themselves. So if we could somehow get a bit in the therapeutic guidelines, then GPs could look at it and go, oh, this is the expert consensus on these things, and these are reasonable medications to prescribe in this setting.
Yep.
So something like that would be really helpful.
Something that Emerge Australia can absolutely work towards.
So I think, something like that. I know they're revamping like the women's health stuff. You know, fantastic. Long overdue. But they're really kind of, and again, once it's in there, it somehow becomes legitimate.
Yeah.
That's kind of something like that would help. Yeah, and then the LPIC group so just try to reach more people. So that, I'm trying to put as much energy as I can in presenting and teaching and that sort of thing, and trying to hopefully make it seem less scary, maybe give a bit of a framework for people to feel more comfortable in. I think we were having a discussion the other day. I think part of it is like, one, we need to get over ourselves. I always think when I was in med school, I thought that little mug which was like, don't confuse your Google search with my med school. It's like, med school is 4 freaking years. Like, it's not very long. And even in med school, they tell us half of what we learned is going to be wrong. We just can't tell you which half by the time you graduate. I thought it was funny when I was a med student.
To provide patients with a lot of confidence.
But that's just the rate of change. Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably worth us remembering that, things change quite a lot. Like the pace, I think the amount of scientific knowledge is like doubling every 1.8 years. Like, it's insane. So I think, we need to kind of, just check ourselves a bit. There's stuff we don't know. I do love misquoting Tony Abbott. No one is a suppository of all knowledge. So, we can always look up something and learn something new. And I think it's that desire to do something. We don't have to do anything to begin with. I think a huge thing just initially would be to listen and to understand patients' story and then commit to working with them. That would be a great start. And we do this in other things. We do this in addiction medicine. We do this in some of the psychological therapies in the chronic diseases, But I think part of it is this kind of desire to, and I experienced this, and it was kind of like I was telling a doctor about my fainting episodes and fatigue, and pretty much, I hadn't even finished, and they were just like, are you on an SSRI? And I was like, no. And it's like, well, should you be? And it's like, oh, no, like, actually, but I don't feel like I'm depressed at all. Like, I'm frustrated at the situation. Like, I'm trying to tell you kind of but immediately. And I think, and this is not to say that mental health can't coexist with ME/CFS and that sort of thing, but like, just from the, quote unquote, art of medicine side of things, you have to meet patients where they're at. So and having an understanding of the context of where they've come from, like that's probably not a super helpful way to start, I would say. No. You know, unless that is what is flagged. But because we know that, you know, most people have been told that it's anxiety or depression. Yes, they can cause fatigue and yes, they can coexist and all that. But I think just from that kind of soft skills, maybe don't lead with that because it will put people offside.
We know it does because that lends itself to looking at the psychosomatic angle, which of course we know that ME/CFS is not psychosomatic. What we do know though is that if you have lost everything, if you've lost the ability to work, if you've lost the ability to function the way you used to, whether that was studying, going to school, working, being a mum, dad, whatever, and you can't do that anymore, then you are going to be suffering from grief and loss. And you're going to be experiencing a whole range of symptoms, you know, mad, bad, glad, sad. All of those symptoms are part of that grief and loss analysis that is often then misunderstood as you must have depression and that's causing your symptoms, which of course it isn't, because it's what's happened to the person with ME, let alone severe ME, that has completely reduced their life to being bedbound or housebound, that has contributed to the feelings of loss that then lead to the feelings of helplessness sometimes that are misinterpreted as, well, you've got depression, why aren't you on medication?
Yeah, so I think, like I said, they can certainly coexist. It can be there, but I would probably say, like, from the soft skills, that wouldn't be my first place to start. I think, I think you need to understand the patient, where they're at, kind of, and build that trust. Because I think, the amount of medical trauma that these patients have been through is, extraordinary. And, I think that was what my experience kind of taught me. Like, I went in with all the privilege, all the power in the world, and I still managed to get myself somewhat gaslit. And, so I can't imagine what it's like for someone who doesn't have that, or a person of color who is, inhabiting a larger body, female, neurodivergent, queer, all the intersectionality. My God, like I had everything going for me and was still basically told I was a waste of space,
What patients get told in various forms. Yeah. All the time.
Yeah. I think probably gory detail that no one really needs to know. But like, when they were doing my lumbar puncture, I was like, oh, look, I can feel something feels weird. I'm not sure it's going right. It's like, no, it's fine. Kept poking. And then like I lost control of my bowels. I'm like, oh my God, like I've actually lost control. And he's like, oh yeah, that's fine. I'm like, I'm pretty sure it's not. And he's like, no, it's all good. And just kept going.
Yeah.
And you're just like, and I kind of know what's going on and I can speak up and was still like, you know what? Like, this is normal. I'm just like, I hope you don't do too many lumbar punctures like this. Yeah. And then he kind of blamed me for he's like, oh, I guess it's probably not clean anymore. I'll stop. Not that I probably pranked something I shouldn't have.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, you've got unique experiences, Jason, and thank you so much for talking about your unique personal experiences, because I'm sure they will give comfort to a lot of people listening to this podcast with severe ME who do feel gaslit today still and do feel that they're not believed and that relationship between clinician and patient where the doctor is saying, we're doing the right thing, we know everything. No, don't worry, we're doing the right thing. What you're feeling right now is not real.
Everyone shits themselves when we do a lumbar puncture. totally normal. Yeah. Can't feel your bits.
I haven't had one.
Normal, it's fine, yeah. Just roll with it. Yeah, I'm an expert. Like, I'm so mad about it.
Yeah, I can. Well, you're still mad. How many years ago was that?
3 years. They also appreciated just how much urinary retention sucks. That's a very uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah, I know about that. But I've thankfully not needed a lumbar puncture in my life. So, but I'll remember your experience if I ever do need one.
Yeah, well, if you shit yourself during it, that's probably a bad thing.
They should probably
stop.
So, I guess what I want to ask you now is, what messages would you like to send to the Australian government and policymakers in general to ensure that the needs of people with severe ME are actually prioritised and adequately addressed?
I think I've made clear I'm not a policy guy. I'm just a somewhat loudmouth clinician. I kind of work on the coalface. My sister is in health policy. I think this is a huge health challenge, and there's vast inequity. There's more of it than we know about because of the, you know, aforementioned difficulty in getting diagnosed. So I think COVID in some ways was very good because it kind of brought that more into the forefront. But it's complex. It takes longitudinal care. It takes time. I think one of the challenges, you know, we have all these issues with the NDIS and the coming changes and the commitment to reduce spending there. You know, I think David in the GP Show podcast, like there was a study from Germany that even increasing people's wellness by, you know, I think it was 15%, which is not an awful lot, made a huge difference in overall spending. Because the thing is, we've got to remember, it's not just the patient, like from a financial standpoint, they need so much support that we're pulling other people out of the workforce to support them. And so I think, yeah, if we can do better for the patients, and yeah, I've certainly got patients who have been able to return to work, or they reduce their need for support, and so their family can re-enter the workforce, I think that's well worth it. So yeah, I'd certainly encourage, you know, it's, well, actually, ETG is that therapeutic guidance isn't government, it's its own private thing. But yeah, you know, if we can support doctors to support these patients, you know, better. There was an article a little while ago around POTS, and I think a minister was like, oh, but we've got the GP management plan. I mean, that's 5 visits across 12 months. Like, it's a start. That's not really enough for these sort of patients. Yeah. I don't know enough about the ins and outs of health economics, but yeah, I think if we can create a better system to support clinicians to help these patients, I think, well, A, it's the right thing to do. It's a humane thing to do. You know, the health inequity is massive. And I think that from that point of view, it's the right thing to do. And then I think, yeah, even from an economic point of view, I think I told this in one of the other podcasts, like, you know, I've got, yeah, some of these young people in the prime of their lives. So there's a couple, you know, that I distinctly remember who they were bedbound for their last 2 years of high school. So which is just devastating for a young person. You know, these are your formative years. You're trying to find your identity, all this sort of stuff. And actually, we got them well enough that they're considering going to university. You know, they can re-engage socially. From the government standpoint, economically, you know.
How did you do that? What did you do that changed their life?
They were honestly quite a lot simpler than some of our patients. Their biggest thing was very significant POTS. And so once we could sort that out, then, you know, through a combination of conservative measures, pharmacological measures, you know, I've got the most amazing group of allied health people who helped me out.
So ask you about the relationship between POTS and ME/CFS. So my understanding, and I'm a lay person, I'm not a doctor, is that people who have ME/CFS often have orthostatic intolerance, mm-hmm. of which POTS is a part. But there's now seeming to be quite a big separation between POTS, which of course can happen as almost being in the cardiovascular space, very separate to ME/CFS. What are your thoughts on that and your defining issues around that? Because that's something that I come across a lot.
Sure. So I've kind of readjusted my thinking around it. Look, POTS is a bit of a dumb term because all it does describe what's happening. It's postural. You stand up, your heart goes fast. It doesn't tell us anything about why it's happening. I mean, so, you know, actually, if you look at the eating disorders hospitalization criteria, if you look at the concussion assessment, there are elements of POTS assessment in there. So it can happen for a lot of different reasons. So it's kind of useful in that it describes something that's happening. It doesn't tell us why it's happening. You know, there was an excellent work, pretty sure it was Australian work, which showed that people with ME/CFS have significantly reduced blood flow to the head and that some sort of orthostatic intolerance is really common. So I think it certainly can be a feature of something, an orthostatic intolerance can be a feature of many different things. I think it is not primarily cardiovascular. I think cardiovascular certainly plays a role, but fundamentally it's a problem of not enough blood getting to where it needs to go. Usually yeah. The brain, but you know, we get like, who's it, Dr. Rebecca Ryan terms it like gastropots, you know? So some people, you know, after they eat, they get this massive shunting into their guts. And there's still probably a problem of it going to, not enough going to their brain because going to their guts, but yeah. And so, yeah, I think it happens for lots of different reasons. I think it's a dysautonomia. It's a problem with the autonomic nervous system controlling blood pressure and heart rate, you know? And I think one of the potential pitfalls of thinking of it purely cardiovascularly is you only think about what levers can you pull cardiovascularly.
Yep.
And so it's like, okay, we'll clamp the heart rate or we'll increase the blood pressure with midodrine or something like that. And look, that certainly can work. I've got this is not how engines work, but in my head, maybe. So, you know, if you've got an engine, like as running fast to try and get enough power to do what you want to do. So if you kind of think of it just purely as a heart rate thing and you just clamp the heart rate, it's like, okay, you can't rev higher than that. You've kind of fixed the revving, but you haven't fixed the actual problem because now it was trying to do its job and now you're actually inhibiting it from doing its job.
Yeah.
So that's why sometimes I think that doesn't work. You know, I was helping out some clinicians who are like, oh, I've put them up to like 60 of propranolol 3 times a day and they still feel terrible. It's like, I mean, if you gave that much to a horse, they'd probably feel bad. There's a lot of propranolol for a small person. And, you know, yeah, it might not be the problem. You know, and I see this sometimes where people put, like they have technical POTS, so they're like 50 lying and they go up to 80. But a young person's heart can do 80. Like that's not an inefficient range. It's a bit different to like, you know, if it's cracking 140, 150, which some patients, like, then probably the heart rate is the primary problem then. But I think if they're going like 50 to 80, it's probably an appropriate compensation for whatever else is going on.
Yeah.
You know, and then say like, you know, something like iodine, good drug, bloody expensive. You're like trying to squeeze it a bit harder.
I understand.
So that, it's again, difficult. Can help. But like, so what I often see is, you know, patients will wee a lot. And so you can kind of squeeze as much as you like, but if you haven't got any fluid in you, it's not nearly that effective. And so actually you might need to plug the leak. And so yeah, it's kind of trying to work out which levers you've got and likely be the most effective, kind of the way I kind of think about.
Thank you for that. Sorry, I throw that in because it's an issue that raises its head with me a lot.
Yeah. So look, I think, you know, I actually really like it when ME/CFS patients have an orthostatic intolerance because, yeah, generally it's one of the easier ones that we've got. We understand it a bit better. Like, we still don't know why it happens, but we've got more effective medications, whether it's heart rate control, whether it's blood pressure control, whether it's fluid control, that sort of thing. Yep. We've got a few more levers to play with. And, yeah, like we're talking about, look, if that takes 10% off your load, that's 10% extra you've got to do something else with.
That's right.
So I think that's well worth it. You know, maybe you can eat. Maybe you can do something enjoyable. Like, I think that's the other thing is, like, you know, this disease makes your world so small. So I think, you know, if I can give you a bit of your capacity back to do something to reconnect with people, to do something nourishing for yourself, well worth it.
Well, Jason, thank you.
That's probably a bit unhinged.
I think that almost answers my last question of what words of hope and encouragement you would offer patients and help them advocate for their needs and access to appropriate care. I think from a clinician's perspective, you've certainly highlighted the possibility of giving patients back a little bit of what they've lost by looking at how you can do something about aspects of their disease. But more importantly, you've given us a really beautiful overview and insight from someone who's got the disease and is making such a huge contribution in the medical world of improving outcomes for this very underserved patient community. So thank you for your time today. And yeah, I found this a really enjoyable time spent with you. So thanks, Jason.
Thanks very much. I understand you're talking to David next week, so you'll get something much more coherent out of him.
I am talking to David, and I've had several chats with Bernard and Emma and others. So yeah.
You'll get something much more coherent out of them.
No, this was lovely. Thank you very much.
I was just going to add one little thing, perhaps for any clinicians and maybe for patients as well, was this: what I tell my patients is, like, look, I'm going to try and work out what's going on and try and fix you, but I might not be able to. My aim is to help you feel well enough of the time, which is a bar that you set and may change over time. I totally nicked that from Dr. Larry Afrin. And I'm going to walk with you until that point. You get bored of me or I run out of ideas. Now, that's kind of the deal that we kind of set.
Well, they're very good planks, aren't they? You've sort of laid it out, and it's what happens in between that is critical. So thank you, Jason, so much. Today's podcast is part of the Emerge Australia series recorded for Severe ME Week in 2026. Our podcasts continue to be a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID and overlapping associated conditions in Australia. Emerge Australia concludes a federal government funding cycle in November, and as we prepare to seek renewed investment, Emerge Australia is proud to be launching the Count ME campaign, a powerful movement to highlight the need for continued momentum and growth in support of patients, dedicated ME research, clinical education and health policy change for Australians within this community. Through Count ME, we will continue to shine a spotlight on groundbreaking developments surrounding these misunderstood and stigmatised conditions and provide critical insights to equip decision makers, ensure appropriate support to effectively meet the needs of our community. Dr. Jason Lamb, thank you so much for your time and for joining me today for our podcast. For those listening, tune in again for our next interview. And don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter and find out ways in which you can support Emerge Australia in our critical work, hop on our website, www.emerge.org.au. Jason, thanks again, and bye for now.
Bye. Thanks so much.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world.